Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, January 11th, 2009. There's a lot going on in the world today. War in Gaza, war everywhere, it seems like. Economic recession, maybe depression, and all sorts of political shenanigans, including a new administration coming in. All this adds up to a lot of media coverage. The media is a big part of the news. Today we're going to have two of the really outstanding media critics of our generation joining us to go through what's happening in the news and why it's happening and what we should make of it. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The 111th Congress is now in session, and the first order of business is a massive economic stimulus package. President-elect Barack Obama has been vocal about his intention to devote part of the money to broadband infrastructure as one of the ways to boost the economy. According to a 2007 study by the Brookings Institution, a 20% increase in broadband adoption, putting the United States on par with a country like Denmark, would create 3 million new jobs. As the Obama transition team shifted into high gear last month, S. Derek Turner, research director of Free Press, put forward a proposal to make world-class high-speed broadband available to all areas of the country, bring new competition to the broadband market, which will help keep prices down, and boost America's slumping standing as a global leader in technology.
There is a sort of intersection and a unison between what is good telecom policy and what is good stimulus policy. And I think we've found that. And the way we achieve this is basically, since things are moving so fast, we try to use off-the-shelf ideas, policy options that have already been debated or programs that are already in place, and essentially tweak those a little bit, boost the funding, and get them out the door as fast as possible. And so we think this is something that's realistic and can be done as soon as possible and start getting new jobs created this year and for the years to come.
Turner wants a high-capacity broadband infrastructure across America, including rural and low-income areas. The $44 billion proposal is a mixture of federal grants, bonds, tax incentives, and credits. Funding would only be awarded for new projects and faster speeds that wouldn't happen otherwise. Accountability, Turner says, is the cornerstone of the package.
We can't simply be writing blank checks to companies and get nothing in return. Money is not going to be used to give companies funds to do things they were already going to do. We only propose supporting new investment beyond what would have already taken place. And there are checks and balances in our proposals to make that happen. That's something we have to absolutely be aware of. And unless the accountability and oversight is there, there's no point to doing it at all. We shouldn't use the money for broadband if there's no accountability and oversight. We should use it for something else. Our proposals are designed to lead to the deployment of next generation, truly robust, fast, broadband networks that we're not seeing deployed in the U.S., but that are commonplace, places like Japan and South Korea.
Since job creation will only come with people actually using broadband services, Turner also includes proposals to stimulate demand, like subsidies for installation, discounts on monthly subscriptions, tax deductions for home computers for children, and a program to purchase laptops and build Wi-Fi networks at schools and libraries. Rural development, healthcare, and public service programs are also covered, along with improved broadband data collection and public access to that data. Turner's is not the only plan that's been given to the Obama transition team. Some have merit, and others are much more industry-friendly.
Some of the other plans that are out there are well-detailed and good. Fiber to the Home Council, their plan is one for bonds for building fiber to the home. We think it's a good plan. There are some other plans that I would be a little cautious about. There's one by an industry-funded think tank that on the surface seems to be reasonable. It's got some good speed goals, and it's a tax credit program. But when you drill down, you actually see that this plan would not actually lead to any new broadband investment and could essentially just be a big gift to the incumbent phone and cable companies. So we need to only work with plans and only adopt plans that are open, transparent, and that have real measurable end goals, and there's real accountability and oversight to make sure that those end goals are reached.
To read Derek Turner's proposal, go to freepress.net/research.
To ring in the new year, we asked media reformers their media wishes for 2009.
Greetings, this is Laura Sand Taylor from Native Public Media. My media reform wish for 2009 includes a celebration of the rich, textured cultures and communities that make up America, making the invisibility of indigenous peoples a practice of the past, terrestrial radio stations for Native nations, ubiquitous open broadband across rural and remote communities, a tribal office at the Federal Communications Commission, and Public Media 2.0 that fuels a network of knowledge for all people.
Happy New Year. This is Inez Gonzalez from the National Hispanic Media Coalition. I'm hopeful that the new administration and the FCC will implement programs that will help increase minority and women ownership in media, including protecting low-power TV stations that produce local programming, and step up its EEO enforcement efforts in order to create diversity in a homogeneous workforce.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 11th, 2009. Please bear with me. It sounds worse with my nose than it is. I've got the sniffles, but I feel great otherwise. And I'm energized by our guests today. We have two terrific guests joining us, two co-authors who are well-known to much of our listening audience. Jeff Cohen, who is with us over the phone lines, is currently the director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, and he is the author of the book Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, great to be with you, Bob.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And also with us, his co-author frequently and another frequent guest here on Media Matters, Norman Solomon, founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a syndicated columnist in his latest book, which you've had him on the show to discuss, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Norman, are you there?
Yes, I am. Great to be here, Bob.
Well, it's really an honor to have both of you together, because getting you together on my show has been a goal of mine for a while, so it's terrific to have you here. And I want to talk about your Pulitzer's column that you do annually and have done now for, I believe, 17 or 18 years. But before we get to that, which is your awards for the worst news stories of 2008, I do want to talk about Gaza, what's going on there, and the press coverage of it. Norman, why don't we start with you? What is your take of what's happening in Gaza, how you understand it as a journalist, and then how would you assess the U.S. news media coverage of it?
Well, I think the best way for journalists to cover a conflict is to include the framework of human rights. Once we get into ideology, nationality, and sometimes religious faith, it gets very murky very quickly. And while journalists are human beings and are personally subject to all sorts of influences, when they do their jobs, especially in reporting, I think that should, as much as possible, go out the window. And not to say callous, but relatively dispassionate accounts of human rights realities are really crucial. So I think a single standard of human rights is absolutely crucial. When you apply that sort of a yardstick to what's going on in Gaza, I don't think there's any question that the violations of human rights and the Geneva Conventions are wholesale and methodical on the part of the Israeli government. It's been true when Hamas has fired rockets into Israel. And at the same time, the scale of the violations and the magnitude of the deaths and injuries is literally a ratio of many hundreds to one. And in that sense, I think reporting with integrity reflects the reality that Israel is engaged in war crimes.
Jeff Cohen, how does the comparison to your knowledge of what's going on in Gaza differ between the United States and that of other countries?
Well, other countries have always had a more even-handed view, and in the media in other countries, there's often a more even-handed look at that struggle between Israel and Palestine. I'm always shocked when I'm overseas and I watch CNN International, and they do stories about abuses of the human rights of Palestinians that I know that if those stories had appeared on CNN in the U.S., a producer could have been fired over them. So even CNN gives a different view of Israel-Palestine and its international audience than it does to the U.S. audience. And one thing I'm struck by, and I've been watching a lot in the last couple days, we keep getting U.S. reporters who are penned in Israel, not able to get into Gaza, sort of guessing at events and giving the Israelis often the benefit of the doubt. And I remember when Saddam Hussein was in power and there was military conflict, anytime any story came out of Iraq, CNN in our country or MSNBC or NBC or CBS would always, the reporters would have to, they'd somehow have to be appended to the story that the story had gotten through Saddam Hussein's censors or was subject to censorship. And it strikes me that when you know that Israel is the reason that a number of reporters cannot get in to cover the conflict firsthand, it seems to me that should be appended to virtually every story from the region about Gaza should be that the Israeli authorities will not allow reporters into Gaza. And it seems to me that would be a basic requirement for independent journalism.
Norman, are you surprised, Norman Solomon, that American journalists, U.S. journalists based in Israel now, and their organizations here in the United States haven't raised more of a ruckus about the sort of treatment of journalists by the Israeli government?
Well, I wish I was surprised, but it's really part of a baseline. And for that matter, you've had pretty well-documented instances in the West Bank over the years of camera people being shot at and even killed by the IDF, the Israeli forces. And that's unfortunately a part of an overall pattern where the media outlets of this country have protested little, if at all. And I would draw a parallel to the belated and weak complaints that happened after the news management and exclusion of journalists from key battlegrounds during the first Gulf War in 1991. You had, in the late spring, a letter from top executives of news agencies in the United States to the Pentagon saying, "We don't like how you excluded us from battlefield environments during the Gulf War," but it was chronically then, as now, too little too late. I think it's outrageous that the U.S. news outlets that claim to be the finest in the country are unwilling to directly challenge, or even, as Jeff has just said, acknowledge on the air and in print, that Israeli censorship, manipulation, and exclusion is central to what they do and don't see in the coverage.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here at WILL AM 580. Coming to you live today, our guests, Jeff Cohen and Norman Solomon, well-known to many of our listeners. Jeff Cohen now at the Park School at Ithaca College and author of Cable News Confidential. Norman Solomon, well-known to you as the head of the Institute for Public Accuracy, author of Made Love, Got War, and newspaper columnist. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters, our phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll free line at 1-800-222-9455. And I do want to let our listeners know I've got a bit of a sniffle, so I'm fine. Otherwise, I feel great. Don't worry about my voice. If we could go back, Norman, just to wrap this up for now, unless listeners call in and want to go further into this, your sense of how important Gaza is for regional and even international politics. Is this just one more of what seems like, in your view, of the endless cascade of events in Israel and Palestine and the region, or is this a decisive turning point?
Well, these events, I think, are unfortunately just another apparent nail in the coffin of perhaps in our lifetimes the potential for real negotiation and reconciliation between Palestinian communities and the Israeli government. And I'm struck by how we've had these opportunities, even the Madrid conference, what, more than a decade and a half ago, where there were glimmers of hope and Oslo and all the rest of it. And yet part of this really depends on the vantage point. And this is one of the pervasive failures of U.S. news media, with few exceptions. When the window on the world is tinted red, white, and blue, then Gaza, yes, it gets to the front pages and the evening news, but then the situation with Palestinians recedes, and it's really seen through and extruded through sort of the lens and aperture of, hey, you know, how does this affect the United States? How does this affect its quote-unquote allies in the region, primarily being Israel? And that vantage point is so different. When I've gone to the Middle East, or if I see media originating from that region, overwhelmingly in the Arab world, also in Iran where I was 3.5 years ago, what is going on with Palestinians is absolutely up front and center, even when governments are fading in and out of their focus, with at the grassroots with people. It's hugely important. So we have the luxury here of saying, well, it's important, it's not important. Condi Rice is focusing on it, she's not. But elsewhere in the world, it has tremendous symbolic and human importance.
Bob, if I could get in here.
Please do, Jeff Code.
The great blogger Glenn Greenwald has been writing a series of blog posts and columns where he talks about how there's virtually no debate about the rightness of what Israel's doing, or the U.S., the rightness of the United States giving Israel billions of dollars to help them do what they're doing. There's virtually no debate in the United States in media circles, mainstream media circles, or in government circles. And it's so different than even how things are in the state of Israel, which is such an irony that many of us who are following the events in Israel, we read in English Haaretz, which is, I don't know, you might even consider it like the New York Times of Israel or the Newsday of Israel. It's something, it's a mainstream daily. And you read Haaretz and you see journalists that are completely 100% opposed to what Israel is doing. Now, you don't see that in the U.S. mainstream media. You see it in the Mexican media, you see it in the Japanese media, you see it in the Indian media, certainly the British media. You see it in the Israeli media, you don't see it here. And, you know, in my book about cable news, Cable News Confidential, I talked about how I was at MSNBC for about a year in 2002-03, and one reporter after another, producer, who had worked in the Middle East, they approached me. They learned that Jeff Cohen, you know, the guy who started FAIR, is now in our newsroom. And one by one, these people with experience in the Middle East would approach me to say that there was only one issue ever in their journalistic careers that it was clear to them that accuracy and even-handedness is not what was wanted by management. And they said it's when they were stationed in the Middle East sending back reports about that conflict in Israel-Palestine, that even-handedness and accuracy was far less important than avoiding any controversy with the organized, you know, Israel right or wrong lobbies, which are so powerful in this country. So I think it's really important for us to understand that the U.S. media, mainstream media view of Israel and the lack of debate about Israel's policies is completely different than virtually every country in the world, including inside the state of Israel.
You know, I've heard that from others as well who've, you know, traveled to Israel, spent time there and all over the world, similar to the comments you just made, Jeff Code, and before that, Norman Solomon. I mean, before we get off the subject, I think that begs the obvious question. Why is that? Why is U.S. news media even more one-sided on this than the Israeli media, which, you know, is in the middle of the war?
I'd say there's two factors. Unfortunately, too much of the mainstream media takes its lead from the governing elite, from the governing classes, from the leaders of the two major parties. And if the leadership in the U.S. government and in the U.S. elite circles are not debating, then the mainstream media figures, okay, well, they must be right. You know, if they're not debating it, well, and they all agree on this foreign policy with regard to Israel-Palestine, well, then who are we in the mainstream, you know, in journalistic circles to question it? And it's sort of insane, because you might remember in 1962, 63, 64, 65, 66, there was virtually no difference between the Democratic and Republican parties on Vietnam. and taking their lead from the fact that the Democrats and the Republican elites were not having any debate about Vietnam. The mainstream media in the 60s, in the early and mid-60s, figured, all right, there's no debate. I think that's a big factor, that too much of mainstream media, if the Democratic and Republican leaders are agreeing on something, then somehow mainstream journalists can't figure out that there might actually be some debate that the American public should hear. And then the second factor, I've alluded to it before, the Israel right or wrong lobbies are just very powerful, very well organized, and can punish political figures and journalistic figures that are independent.
And I'd add just that the spiral then has the other component, which is people on Capitol Hill are terrified of being attacked in the media as anti-Israel and the canard anti-Semitic, whereas if they're simply talking about human rights and even-handed human rights foreign policy, that should be absolutely proper.
Our guest today, Norman Solomon, you just heard, Jeff Cohn right before him here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. It's a live show, so we're taking calls at 333-9455, toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. We've been talking about the Gaza war that's going on, the massacre, the press coverage of it, and we are going to talk about a whole range of issues in the news today and how the press is covering them. But first, let's go to our phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Jeff Cohn and Norman Solomon.
Yeah, first I just wanted to say thank you very much for bringing this up, because I am always amazed at when, you know, it's very difficult for me to read anything in the newspapers about the coverage of what's going over on in Gaza, because it is always so one-sided. So I guess my other question is, where can we find more balanced news about what's going on? Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Jeff, if I could go to you first, you mentioned Glenn Greenwald before.
Yeah, I think there's been, in the independent media, I think there's been much more even-handed coverage, and it's a good new development. Glenn Greenwald is an amazing blogger who can be found at Salon.org. You know, you can get the Israeli paper in English every day. You can go to the website of Haaretz, and also, you know, you can, I go to CommonDreams.org, which has been covering this conflict using the Guardian newspaper from London, the Independent from London. They get Haaretz on CommonDreams.org. I think God for the Internet, or thank Al Gore for the Internet. You know, we have the ability to follow the events in another part of the world with a lot more accuracy and a feeling that we're really getting different sides by using the Internet.
Norman, do you have places you like to go to get your information on Middle East politics, or in, stretching it out, including really to Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter?
Yeah, well, Juan Cole is great as an academic who speaks in a decipherable way. As an expert, Juan Cole and his website. In addition to Common Dreams, I mean, there are many others. Truth Out, Alternet, I think, has done a very good job as well.
Okay, our guests, Norman Solomon and Jeff Cohn. Let's go back to the phone lines at Media Matters now to line 2. Urbana, you're on the air.
Yes, no one has mentioned the 6,000 rockets fired by the Hamas since 2005. My view is both sides have gone crazy.
Yeah.
Israel and its disproportionate response and its refusal to our sustaining settlements, keeping those, enlarging them, but as both, since both sides are actively trying to kill women and children, that crosses a line, and in that respect, the Palestinians are no less guilty than Israel.
I appreciate your comment. I agree with virtually everything you said. But Norman Solomon had mentioned the, you know, it's a huge violation of Geneva Convention and any kind of standard of human rights to be firing rockets at civilians, where you have no idea who's going to be killed on the other end. The abuses and violations are on both sides. It's just the greater number of victims in terms of dead and wounded are inside Gaza.
Yeah, I notice in the media there's a lot of focus on the number of rockets that have been fired out of Gaza. And as I did mention earlier, yes, that is absolutely a violation of human rights and the Geneva Conventions to be firing these rockets out of Gaza into Israel. What gets less attention in the media is, yes, there are thousands of rockets that have gone in, then Israel has in turn attacked Gaza and vice versa. But those thousands of rockets have killed a few people. You can count on one hand the number of people they have killed. Now, every one is a war crime. At the same time, there is a matter of actual facts. And when you have three or four or eight over a period of years, Israelis killed, and you have hundreds and hundreds of people in Gaza killed and literally thousands of now injured, to just say these are, you know, equal in magnitude war crimes, I don't think that really holds up. Phyllis Bennis at the Institute for Policy Studies, I think, has been very clear on this throughout, and she has made the point at a time when it's almost impossible to find on the front page, say, of the New York Times or other major outlets in the United States, that sort of a direct comparison and then drawing some real conclusions about it.
You know, if I could ask you to follow up with that, Norman Solomon, I think that in the news media, sometimes what's missing is some sense of the scale of the Israeli military vis-a-vis not just the Palestinians, but in the region and other and globally, and also the role of the United States in supporting the Israeli military.
Yeah, well, definitely. When you have, depending on some accounts, Israel has the third or fourth most powerful air force on the planet. You have military alliances between Israel and Turkey, for instance. You have then the canard. You know, it's part of a bias that, you know, I talk about in the film based on my book, War Made Easy, that if you kill people from high technology launched from 1,000 feet in the air, that is considered, if it is paid for by the U.S. Treasury, generally in the U.S. news media, to be a rather sanitary and even civilized way to kill people. But if they're crude rockets or they are explosives put in a suicide belt and then people are blown up on the ground, that's considered to be a 180 from morality. I think those who grieve don't really care what the technology is.
Our guests, Jeff Cohn and Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580. The phone number, if you care to join us and speak with our guests, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now let's turn, if we can, to the Pulitzers. Jeff Cohn, what are the Pulitzers? What's their origin? And then let's talk about some of the winners for this year's contest.
Well, you know, when Norman and I started this 17 years ago, there were so many awards recognizing the great performances in journalism, the investigative reporting, the breaking stories, and the award after award after award. And I think it was Norman's idea to put out an award that recognized the stinkiest performances of the year. That's where we came up with the Pulitzer Awards. And, you know, there are certain people that I notice. We got some complaints that we didn't have Fox News in here represented much, or Limbaugh, or Bill O'Reilly, but we had people like, you know, some of our favorite award winners this year were Chris Matthews and David Brooks. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, and Matthews from MSNBC.
Yeah. And also, you had John Burns of the New York Times getting an award. And, you know, I want to go through some of the awards, but I think there are some recurring themes through the years, not just in the Pulitzers, but also in the work, Jeff, that you and Norman Solomon have done. And one of the things I think is really interesting is this notion that politicians who are centrist are non-ideological, whereas politicians on the left or the right, especially on the left, really rarely on the right, are ideological.
Well, it goes to this old idea that you'll hear a lot from mainstream reporters is, I'm not biased toward the left or the right, I'm straight down the center. Now, if you said that in Europe, where they have multi-party systems, sometimes three, four, five, six parties, and one or two of those parties are centrist parties, that you'd be laughed out of the room. If you said, well, I have no bias because I'm a centrist, people in Europe might understand, okay, this guy's admitting his bias, he's got an ideology, it's called centrism. But in our country, if you are a elite mainstream media professional and you say, no, no, I place myself right in the middle between the two political parties, then somehow that isn't an ideological choice. And the reality is, as we know in our country, that the leadership of the Democrats and the Republicans are sometimes, both leaderships, are to the right of the public. And if mainstream media just positions itself in the middle of the leadership of those two parties, then they would be, you might be ignoring or biasing toward a minority position and ignoring the most of the political spectrum in our country. And I would say that happens a lot on economic and foreign policy issues.
You know, Norman Sullivan, you were a delegate for Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention. You spoke about that on our program last year. And since he has been elected, he's begun to appoint his cabinet, I think the general sense, and you report on this in the Pulitzers, is that he is appointed conservative to moderate Democrats in the vast majority of posts, certainly not from the left or liberal wing of the party. How has the press handled this, and how have you personally responded to this?
Well, I think the press has handled it overwhelmingly with adulation, overwhelmingly applauding this as some kind of move to a civil discourse, and the notion that corporate centrism represents a sort of an ultimate fruition of a civic engagement and less partisanship, that theme generally plays really well. And I think in general, if there is going to be a lean towards an ideology that's more off of or away from the center of political gravity of the country, it's much more likely to be applauded when it's a move rightward. And we saw that in the deregulatory mania of the 1980s and then in this decade with Reagan and then George W. Bush. But that said, I think now we're entering an era of avowed and media-claimed centrism. But if you open the hood and you look at the machinery underneath that very appealing to many people gloss of middle of the road or moderate or whatever, you see the enormous engines of corporate power revving up, the profit taking off Wall Street of the bailouts, the definitions of what is reasonable to even look at. And that's where I think the corporate orientation of mass media really reinforce, if not foreclosing, at least making a very steep uphill climb, genuinely progressive, even vigorous New Deal type of solutions to the economic crisis.
And Bob, if I could specify, one of the awards that we gave out this year, we called it the Status Quo Centrist Can't Be Ideologues Award. And we wanted to award it to someone, but there were just too many that tied. You know, so, I mean, for example, the New York Times has a front page report about this was his, Obama's choices for Secretary of State and Secretary of Treasury, and they say his choices suggest that Mr. Obama is planning to govern from the center right of his party, surrounding himself with pragmatists rather than ideologues, unquote. And then USA Today, the same topic. Obama's selections had, quote, records that display more pragmatism than ideology, unquote. So here you have it, I mean, over and over for a period of weeks in every mainstream outlet, it was this idea reinforced that, you know, if you thought invading Iraq and signing the NAFTA trade deal were good ideas, well, then you're a pragmatist. You know, if you thought those might have been bad ideas, you're an ideologue, you're a liberal. And it's really getting absurd. And, you know, we saw this in so many different outlets, we couldn't specify one winner.
Our guest, Jeff Cohn, or Norman Sullivan here at Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a full bank of phone callers wanting to talk with our guests. So let's go directly to the phone lines. Line 3. Champaign County, you're on the air with Cohn and Sullivan. Hello, line 3. I guess line 3 grew impatient. Let's go then to our toll-free number, line 4, Chicago. Chicago, you're on the air with Cohn and Sullivan. Hello, Chicago?
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. You were commenting about the imbalance of lives lost on the Israeli side compared to the Palestinian side, yet it's not for the Palestinian side lack of trying. They have purposely tried to target civilians, kindergartens, schools, wherever they can reach with their rockets. And Israel, right now, in their ground assault, is trying to go out of its way to avoid civilian casualties. But the Hamas people, they actually use their people as a human shield.
Well, look, you know,
so
this
it's their fault that civilians are being killed, not Israel's fault.
Okay, well, thank you, caller Norman Solomon, but how do you respond to that?
Yeah, the range and extent and magnitude of carnage in Gaza was totally predictable. And right as the assault began weeks ago, Phyllis Bennis at the Institute for Public Accuracy said this will kill many, many civilians. There's no way it's not going to happen. So, you know, the gentleman called from Chicago. If people went up and down the shopping district streets of Chicago at noontime spraying the storefronts with machine gun fire and did it consistently day after day while people were shopping, the fact that they weren't targeting individuals would be no solace to the hundreds of people who were wounded and those who mourned those who were killed.
But Norman, what about the charge that the Palestinians are sort of hiding behind their civilians, the terrorists, so they're the ones who are responsible for children being killed?
Well, we've heard that consistently when wars are taking place and one side doesn't like the fact that they're being opposed by another side. The Geneva Conventions are very clear that if fighters are in the population, it's not justified to go in and kill the population. And there's a tremendous and rather sickening irony here. Gaza, with 1.5 million people, is one of the, if not the most crowded stretches of real estate on the planet. Israel has Gaza penned in and then says that the civilians are being used as civilian shields by the fighters.
Let's go back to our phone lines right now. Line 1, St. Joseph, you're on the air with Norman Solomon and Jeff Cohen.
Yes, someone called in and wanted to know where they might get more information other than our parochial news sources, and may I suggest The Economist. It's usually out on Tuesday at the bookstores. My subscription usually comes in on Tuesday, and it certainly has a much wider view than you're going to find locally. And if I may say, in my view on the Middle East situation, a plague on both their houses. That's all.
Yeah, I think that the suggestion of The Economist is a good one. I guess the point I was trying to make at the very beginning of the show is the mainstream media, virtually every country in the world, tries to cover Israel-Palestine in a more even-handed way than the mainstream media in the U.S., and The Economist is fine. I think if when I read British publications who cover the Middle East in a thorough and independent way, I look very closely to what The Guardian is reporting about events in Israel, Palestine, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. I look to the London Independent as well as The Guardian.
You know, the last two callers have referred to they or their houses. And unfortunately, that's a way that we blur and numb ourselves in the United States. The U.S. Treasury sends a few billion with a B dollars a year to the Israeli government. Those being burned and killed right now are undergoing that process courtesy of the largesse of U.S. taxpayers. But perhaps more fundamentally, it isn't a bunch of theys. There are children, there are old people who are Israelis, who are Palestinians, numerically much higher number, who are dying and being wounded. So to talk about they and a plague in all their houses, believe me, these are not different caliber of human beings in these populations. They're people, and when we think we're above or beyond them, then we are delusionary.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Norman Solomon, you just heard, Jeff Cohen, also joining us. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, and for a great show and focus on an important topic. I think just playing off the last comments, I wonder if your callers, I mean, following Gideon Levy's piece in today's Haaretz, kind of focuses on this particular aggression in revealing the deep racist roots of this conflict and this unbridled aggression and brutality, particularly of this incursion, I mean, of an otherwise occupied people. So the question really is, how does a human rights framing begin to get at the deep racist and pervasive roots within this conflict, and maybe within that context in the sort of post-Obama period as well? So I'll hang up and listen and see what you guys make of the racist underpinnings of this conflict.
Well, thank you very much.
My perception is, from U.S. politics and media anyway, that the prevailing bias and spin and sort of countersigning the blank bloody check is multifactorial, and I believe racism is a part of it. I also think that sort of the conventional idea that if the U.S. through Washington declares itself to be allied with some regime around the world, there's a strong tendency to spin in that direction. And then there's the pro-Israel lobby, some of what I think is a very misguided and destructive tendency of Jews to say, well, I'm going to support Israel, right or wrong. A ferocious lobby for Israel, such as the AIPAC lobbying group. Those factors really combine. But, you know, back to racism, it's certainly, I don't think it's the only factor, but I think it is a significant one.
And I think in the U.S. media and in U.S. political mainstream debate, I think it's sort of acceptable to engage in making comments about Arabs or Muslims that would not be acceptable about any other group. And I think we saw in the Obama campaign, for example, when the Obama campaign staffers asked two women that were wearing headdresses, they were Arab Americans, I think it was an event in Michigan, and asked them to move because they didn't want to seem to be inclusive of that group. It's really a special case in U.S. media where there's certain things you can't say about Jews, about blacks, about Latinos, but it seems like you can get away with saying certain things about Arabs or Muslims. You can't generalize about the whole group of Jews in our media because of one individual who's Jewish. You can't do that about African Americans, but it seems that Muslims are as a group spoken badly of in the mainstream media, or Arabs, and it's okay.
Well, I think Jeff Cohen, along those lines, was John McCain, I think in his final town hall of the campaign, when a woman came up to him and said, you know, I think Obama is a Muslim or an Arab, and his response is, no, he's a fine man. He's
right,
a family man.
I mean, and you know what she meant to say, the person who said, I believe Obama's an Arab, she meant to say Obama's a Muslim. And to her, Muslims and Arabs are the same, even though, for example, you know, half of the Arab Americans are not Muslims. And, you know, in our country, so many Arab Americans are Christians. And if you go overseas, most Muslims are not Arabs. There's so many countries, you know, throughout the world that are Muslim that are not Arab. But in our media, there's so little understanding of this issue. There's so little serious reporting that that our people who vote in elections don't know the basic, you know, what are Arabs, what are Arab Americans, what are Muslims, what are Muslim Americans. We just don't know. And it's really sad that, you know, in 2008, and, you know, 7 years after 9/11, our mainstream media are doing so badly in imparting basic facts about these groups and these regions in the world.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Jeff Cohn, you've just been listening to, and Norman Solomon, also on the line with us. I'm Bob McChesney. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We'll make sure we get to as many callers as possible. Let's go back to the phones right now. Line 3, Champaign County, do we have you this time?
Yes, you do. I wanted to ask about three rather disparate things, actually. One is, do people know if there's been any reporting of the use of white phosphorus in the American press? Because I've heard it on BBC. I don't know if you have people looking for that, because that seems to be another racist. This is a use of a American-made product, and the U.S. used it in Ramallah and Fallujah. It's a hideous weapon. You have to have dehumanized your opponents to be able to use it. On another issue entirely, the election system in Israel, it's obviously this is multi-determined, the timing of this, but the election system in Israel has been changed to sort of first past the post for the prime minister, if I understand correctly. And I'm wondering whether you've thought about the dynamics of that vis-a-vis this. I mean, I guess there was a demonstration by a peace group in Israel that called this the six Knesset seat war.
Yeah.
Because and then there one last thing. I'm sorry, but maybe for Norman Solomon, Alexander Coburn in his latest posting asserted that Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor, when he was military attaché, basically working with Fatah to start the coup against Hamas, the opposite of what's been asserted, that he actually offered a report to the State Department, Condi Rice, and it was never released to anyone because it was so critical of Israel. I wonder whether you know the basis for that assertion and whether it has any implications down the road. Thanks.
No, I don't know the specifics of that, but even the sort of the context where Hamas was actually promoted by the U.S. government as a counter to what we now call Fatah, PLO, that's a bit of history that should be examined.
Well, what happened was the Israeli government, perhaps trying to, you know, intelligence agency too smart by half, was funding some of the groups that evolved into Hamas because they wanted an alternative to the secular radicals or leftists that were grouped around the PLO, and that was happening, I believe, in the 70s and early 80s.
How about the phosphorus, the electoral system?
Yeah, on the election issue, you know, Ehud Barak is the minister of war here. You know, he's their defense minister in the government of Olmert. And this is his war. This is his attack on Gaza. And many peace voices in Israel, in the Israeli mainstream media, and in the streets, as this caller said, when they hold up their signs, they're saying this is a war about an election. And I think we have some familiarity with that in our country. As you know, we know they rushed to have a vote about invading Iraq before the November 2002 election in our country. And so many people believe this is Ehud Barak, the head of the Labor Party, trying to pick up a half a dozen seats in the Israeli parliament, known as the Knesset, in terms of the choice of the timing and other decisions made around invading Gaza, that this is partly to help politicians. There's nothing more sickening than innocent people dying on both sides because some politician thinks it'll help his career or some politicians.
Do either of you know much about this phosphorus concern that the caller had?
I haven't seen it in the mainstream media here. I've seen it in the British media, where from some of the witnesses in the hospitals in Gaza, some of the doctors are questioning whether white phosphorus, a chemical, is being used. But I haven't seen it in the U.S. mainstream media. Maybe I've missed it.
Well, let's go back to the phone line again, if we can. Let's go to line one now, Urbana. You're on the air with Jeff Cohen and Norman Solomon.
Thanks. What strikes me about the media's coverage and looking at the historical context is, a Palestinian friend of mine remembers his family's house, which they had to flee during the earlier conflicts, and, you know, basically remembers this house that now Israelis are living in or are living in the land on it, and yet, you know, despite the balance the media tries to establish, they don't seem to kind of gloss over that historical fact when analyzing why Hamas might be doing what it does.
Well, and I've been looking in vain trying to find some explanation of how all these Palestinians got put in that little strip, and, you know, many, many, many of them lived in what's now southern Israel. And those villages used to have Arabic names, and now they have Hebrew names. And I think that might add a little context. Again, no one here would want to justify a religious fundamentalist group like Hamas, which has shown contempt for the well-being of civilians. But I certainly want to know how these people got to be living in the Strip, and you just don't get that kind of historical context that many of them, if going back generations, lived in what's now southern Israel, and they don't live there anymore.
You know, it's really stunning to go back to the summer and early fall of 1967, the coverage in the New York Review of Books by I.F. Stone. He was writing in real time, and he understood, you know, at that moment and foreshadowed more than four decades, really, what was involved. And he basically had a journalist's ear and a humanist's heart for the humanity of all people in the conflict. It's really a historical perspective and even an ethical framework that's grievously missing from U.S. media coverage ongoing.
You know, if I could shift gears for the last 10 minutes or so of the program, because there's so much ground I want to cover, but the other great story in the world today, I think, is the threat of an economic depression.
Yeah.
Not just a recession, but a depression. I think the figures today, by all accounts now, suggest an economy that will be the worst economy since the 1930s. I mean, I think we've already blown through the early 80s and early 70s recessions. And how have you guys, in your assessment of the news media, seeing the coverage of the bailout, the nature of the debate over this issue as it's played out for Americans in the press?
Well, I think a watershed was clearly the end of September and early October, the $700 billion bailout with the three-page scenario from Paulson on how to engineer this whole thing. And you had just a remarkable near, not total, but near consensus from the punditocracy. And one of the winners of the Pulitzers for 2008, David Brooks, I think really epitomizes that. There was this, I would say, hysterical opposition to anybody in the House of Representatives who had voted down initially the $700 billion bailout for Wall Street. And David Brooks was part of that. He said that the members of the House who hadn't voted for it were failing to heed, and I'm quoting here, the collected expertise of the Treasury and Fed, unquote. And the headline writer of his piece referred to it as I recall, the revolt of the nihilists. You know, these people who were balking were just perceived as being absolute idiots. And yet after, through the bludgeoning from the media and others, the House reversed itself and approved a bailout that really wasn't much better. The credit crunch just continued unabated after that. The stock market, for what that's worth or important, kept plunging. So a week later, after Brooks has denounced people for not heeding the, quote, collected expertise of the Treasury and Fed, Brooks writes in his New York Times column, and I'm quoting here, at these moments, central bankers and Treasury officials leap in to try to make the traders feel better. Officials pretend they're coming up with policy responses, but much of what they do is political theater, unquote.
Yeah, you know, if I could continue, Norman's pinned down, I think, a key moment in the history of U.S. media. It's almost a case study. You know, most of the American public was against this bailout. It was being rushed through. I think their common sense instinct is this will probably help the rich. It probably won't solve a problem. So most of the American public is against the bailout. Congress members on the right wing and on the left wing are against the bailout. But if you look for debate in mainstream media circles, you could hardly find any. Indeed, all they were doing was name-calling of people who were questioning the $700 billion bailout. And then we learn a few weeks later that these people that were doing the bailout, who are saying, unless we do the bailout and do it exactly our way, we're going to have a disaster. You realize it was pure guesswork. They changed directions 180 degrees, and they are utterly clueless in many ways. The bailout was not going for the toxic documents, the toxic securities. Instead, a number of institutions were using it to just acquire other institutions. It was, as usual, taxpayer money helping the big guys get even bigger. So as I talk to, like, members of the public, and when I do lectures, You know, think about what we've learned in the last 8 years, that these allegedly smart guys that we've, that the U.S. media has taught us and told us over and over, mainstream media, you know, let's leave foreign policy to these bright guys, the Council of Foreign Relations or the Kissingers or the Rumsfelds or the Colin Powells or the Condis. You know, we know if you leave foreign policy to those guys now, many Americans realize these people are clueless about foreign policy, and you would think that there'd be that same questioning at these people who pretend to have answers with regard to our financial meltdown and other economic problems. I think it's healthy for the American public to realize that the people who've been placed in charge of the economy by Obama are some of the people that helped cause the crisis in the first place, and that these people, like the Bush people, know no more about solving the economic mess than they know about foreign policy. I think that's a healthy skeptical attitude for the public to have and for journalists to have.
But at least they're not ideologues.
Right.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller today on Media Matters. Let's go to line four. Tuscola, you're on the air with Jeff Cohn and Norman Solomon.
I thank you for a refreshing program. I just want to bring out a few points. Is that humanitarian killing of civilians was done in World War II by Americans extensively near the end of the war, firebombing in Germany, and, of course, the atomic bomb in Japan. It just depends who's doing it and who's reporting it, I guess. I think also it's rather interesting that the Israelis, who most are very devout Jewish people that believe in an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, are going for an eye, and their eye is taken out, but they're taking an arm and a leg. And I don't know, understand this type of thinking, knowing that it's going to just increase more hatred for the Israelis. Could you comment?
Thank you very much, caller. Jeff, Norman, who wants to go first?
Norman.
Well, it's a really horrific pattern, and I would parallel it to the sort of the economic corporate outlook that says, I don't really care about the long term. I'm looking at the next three quarters and how I'm going to come up smelling like a rose or smelling bad. For elections and officials, it's often, oh, I don't really care long term. As George W. Bush said in an interview a few weeks, long term history, well, I don't really care. I won't be around. I don't think about it. And the same goes for these policymakers who are leaning on and depending on so-called military solutions that are just kicking the bloody can down the road and making things worse.
Yeah, I think that this caller raises an interesting question that could be asked about U.S. policy in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere, that sometimes these policies that might make macho individuals feel good, that we're punishing people, we're punishing the enemy, a lot of times they lead to just more hatred and more violence and more warfare down the road. Norman Solomon, in the movie based on his book, War Made Easy, Norman, give the figures, the percentage. I mean, every war, in every war, the number of civilians that die as a total percentage of all people dead just keeps increasing, and you'd think that by the year 2009 we'd be looking for alternatives to war because it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, it's climbed
terrorism. What's the percentages, Norman?
It's climbed about 90% of those who die in war now, in most cases, are civilians.
And in World War One, for example, the number of the percentage of people dying who were civilians, I think it was 10%.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, that's truly extraordinary. We've only got a few seconds left. Norman, in about 20 seconds or less, can you just give me a quick thumbnail on your sense of Afghanistan since that's about to queue up as the major war?
Well, I think it's similar to 1965. All the conventional wisdom told President Johnson, you got to send, we applaud you for sending, escalate in Vietnam. I think it's a similar kind of a madness we're now seeing about escalating in Afghanistan.
Well, on that note, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Jeff Cohn, good luck at the Park School at Ithaca College.
Thank you.
And Norman Solomon, good luck with all your great work at the Institute for Public Action. It's been a pleasure having both of you on the air.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
All right, take care. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, who's been working the board, and I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. Be back in 167 hours. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for central Illinois, today should be mostly cloudy with a high of 31 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow flurries and a low of 23. Tomorrow, cloudy with snow arriving in the afternoon, a high of 33 degrees. Tomorrow night, cloudy with some snow and colder with a low of 10. Tuesday, cloudy with flurries and a high of only 14 degrees. This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.